You're listening to Campus Review Radio.
Welcome to HeadX, hosted by Martin Betts. This podcast explores the changing landscape of the higher education sector. Welcome to the Higher Education Experience.
Well, it's great to be back in the HeadX studio again so soon after the UA conference and the University of Court. I'm joined by Paul Harper, my co-host from University of Queensland. How are you, Paul?
I'm really good. It's great to be here again with you and just back from Canberra with you.
Yes, we had a very busy time there last week, didn't we? You had a Universities Enable workshop and an event. We recorded a podcast of those live in the audience, and we all listened. Mary O'Kane describe her records for the other end of the process and reflect upon the vision it provided to us all. What's your memories of last week, Paul?
Well, being down there listening to thought leaders talk about thought leadership around the University's Accord. When we had the Disability Royal Commission has just come out, the NDIS, so they're both of them in the disability space. Skills Australia, there were so many reports, so much activity. I think it was a really pumping Universities Australia conference. And I think listening to Minister Clare, listening to Mary, you know, really insightful about what's next in the Universities Accord. And speaking to thought leaders, our guest today was down there with us, and he's also a thought leader.
Well, why don't you tell us who we've got on today, Paul? You find some fascinating people, and you mix with all of the thought leaders that are thinking the leading things, and I'm intrigued to have the conversation that you've set up for us today with our guest, who is...
Shamet Sarkar, who is the executive director of the recently renamed Australian Centre for Student Equity and Success. Now, that's based in Curtin University. It was previously known as the National Centre for Student Equity in Higher Education. Now, Shamet's been at Curtin for over 5 years, having gained his doctorate from an area I believe you know quite well, Martin, being the University of University of Essex, which is, of course, in Martin's hometown of Colchester.
I've got very good memories of Colchester, of Essex, of that university, and of all sorts of things that I got up to on that campus. But yes. Probably better leave some of them out of this episode.
Yes, probably. Well, I got to know Shamet really well because we both served on Minister Clare's Universities Accord Ministerial Reference Group. And through our work on that, we contributed significantly to the equity and diversity and inclusion space. And I think we'll get to a bit more of that, how we, what we think of the Accord and our contributions a bit later. So perhaps, Shamet, welcome.
Hi, Paul, and hi, Martin. Nice to be here. And I'm just sitting back enjoying your sort of conversation about past things and present. And let's see if we can talk a little bit about this so-called thought leadership. It'd be lovely to chip in.
Well, it certainly will. And it's great to have you on the podcast, Shamet, and we'll hear a lot more from you as Paul and I give you some questions to deal with straight after this message from our sponsors.
Short on resources to enhance your university's online learning objectives? OES's collaborative approach ensures program success while offering flexibility across disciplines. Our tailored solutions uphold academic rigour and your reputation. Choose OES for adaptable, high-quality online learning experiences.
So, Shamet, welcome to the podcast again. Yeah, and look, I'm intrigued by people's stories that bring them to the sort of conversations that we have on this platform, and love to know what you got up to at Essex and the university in Colchester. But your first discipline is in politics and government relations. Studied at, we know Essex in academic circles as a real leader of the social sciences and of the disciplines related to government relations and politics. And I can only assume that your story's got a deeper root than just going to learn things at Essex. Where are you from? What's your early life experiences that have set you on this path of being an academic and ending up now being on this side of the world, leading Australia's national efforts for student equity and success at Curtin? Tell us a bit about your story and your journey of how you came to be where you are today.
Sure, Martin. I mean, as you say, you know, there's a story behind these things. And the older I've grown in my 37-year academic career, the more I realize this story is integral to the profession. There's an old expression, which eventually your biography becomes your bibliography and vice versa. And I definitely sort of take that view now. I didn't used to take it a long time ago. But about me, look, it's very simple. I'm 60 years old. When I was just 18, I failed to get into the LSE with my A-level scores. I didn't go to a particularly illustrious North London comprehensive school. I think we sometimes call them dump comprehensives or dump schools, but that was then. And I got into the University of Essex, which probably wouldn't have existed had there not been some visionary leadership in the 60s to set up universities for all or for more people. I think about 2 or 3% of people used to go to universities, mostly the well-heeled in the UK. So I got a chance and I sort of scraped in or did well, or I can't remember, but I got into my second choice university. Had no idea, I think I visited once, but had no idea that actually, funny enough, it turned out to be a seat of great learning in my chosen field, which is political science. I didn't know that actually. Why would I? But I'll share with you a little anecdote that goes behind that. And I'll tell you the short version. So I went to this not terribly illustrious state school in North London. I think I was sort of bright. The teachers kind of took a shine to me. And eventually I found my way to the headmaster's office. Principal's office. And he said, you've been asked to see me because, you know, you've got some university ambitions or something like that, you know? And I said, yeah, that's great, yeah. And he said, well, look, you know, blah, blah, blah. 30 minutes later, he said, you really should sit down with me sometimes, have a meeting, and we'll talk about Oxbridge, which for listeners of this podcast is Oxford and Cambridge. It's a shorthand we use there. I then duly went home, really, you know, excited, about 16, 17, whatever. And I said to my dad, we've got to brush up on Uxbridge, UXBRDGE. Uxbridge is an outer London suburb in London, probably got nothing to do with Oxbridge, except I think Uxbridge is on the way to Oxford if you drive.
It's the end of the Metropolitan line, isn't it?
Exactly. So the point is, and he's got his university, it's called Brunel. I know the VC there currently. My point is, I went home with all the bright brain cells that you can imagine in my mind fired up, but with little or no social capital. Social capital is not what you know, it's who you know. So no one in my family was able to translate the term Oxbridge. I thought it meant Uxbridge. You see where the story's going, okay? The bottom line is, I thought I'd hit the jackpot, and I didn't, okay? So yeah, that's an interesting little anecdote. I sometimes bring that up with friends and family. But anyway, I going back to Essex, I got an undergraduate degree in political science, did quite well. Next thing I know, I'd rocked up to do a PhD months after I'd graduated my first degree. And I was fortunate having a couple of really good academic mentors, you know, people who taught me. David Sanders, who is the Regius Professor of Government, now retired there, a youngish guy, great, great champion of mine. Ivor Crewe, who went on to become the Vice Chancellor, Master of University College, Oxford. And he and I are still very much sort of in touch with each other, doing stuff together, et cetera, et cetera. And then the late Anthony King, who was an institution, taught me. And he taught me something about the importance of political communication, not political analysis, and so on and so forth. So I end up having sort of a reasonably illustrious academic career, climbed the greasy pole. Midway through my 30s, I got a little bit bored. I got tempted to look at how the real world works, get my hands dirty in academia. I went and served on lots of boards and commissions and stuff. And at the age of 38, I walked into Number 10 as part of Blair's staff in the second Blair term and became a senior advisor to him. And the rest is almost history. I mean, I just spent the last 20 odd years, the second half of my career, being an academic, but also a policymaker and a practitioner. And at the risk of boring your listeners to death, apart from working in government, I went on to work in commerce, chaired a large company. I went to work in regulation. I chaired an important legal regulatory board. And then lots of other things in between, philanthropy, nonprofits, and so on. I really enjoyed it because I've always thought that academia and the use of knowledge are two sides of the same coin. I could go on, but you get the kind of rough sense of my background, yeah.
That's a fascinating story of getting to the end of the Metropolitan line looking for Oxford and Cambridge, if that's how I might summarise the early part of that. And then
you got it, yeah.
Realising the difference between the two, and a fascinating tour through some of the real periods of change in New Labour and things that could only get better. and rebranding of great institutions. And that's not too long a bow to my next question, which is really about here you are now then, leading a centre that's pretty widely applauded and lauded as a great step forward for equity in universities in Australia. I hope I'm not giving you too big a billing there. That I was really acutely aware of it a year ago when it got a great mention from Jason Clare in the UA conference gala dinner in Parliament. But here you are, as Paul said in introducing you, recently having rebranded it, the new Australian Centre for Student Equity and Success. So without going all the way along the metropolitan line to the current day in that centre, tell us a little bit about the centre, its history, its progress to date, and why it's necessary to rebrand it in 2024.
Yeah, look, I'd be delighted to. So look, I had the great pleasure of taking over a centre that's got great academic pedigree. I think it was born out of the Bradley report in 2008, the spirit then of trying to make universities more inclusive, etc. So it got cracking in terms of research on equity, large and small, in Australian universities. And it's got a decade plus of excellent research behind its belt. So it's a great privilege to take over an ongoing concern and so on. But the thing is, you know, I think the feds understood that in terms of funding it, what they wanted was not just that, they wanted something that could really make a difference to policy and practice. And then I was recruited to head that and so on. And my background of late has been sort of helping to establish what we call in the UK called what works centres, taking, you know, complex research analysis, boiling it down to what really works, best practice, what would be the tools or the mechanism to get the best result given, you know, fixed resources or whatever. There's a lot of best practice out there because there's a lot of average practice. So you need to get the two things sorted out. So I've tried to, you know, well, we've set up to be explicitly that. In the UK, there's something called TASO, Transforming Access and Student Outcomes, which does a similar role. It helps universities to improve their game, as it were. And so that pivot has been very, very deliberate and very explicit. And I want to make sure that it's very much understood, not just in, you know, listeners' minds, but the most important thing is in the minds of 39 vice chancellors. You know, we're here to help. The feds are putting a lot of money into it. They're putting a lot of expertise. It's my great privilege to lead, 15, 20 people who work, you know, with me and for me. And we need to get it right. You know, and we've got, you know, some detailed sort of programs that sit behind that vision. Because I think the key thing is, you know, it's good that we're here doing this, and it's important that we're doing this. And thanks to Jason, you know, giving us a shout out a year ago. But the qualification is always that we don't run universities. I don't run any universities. I just happen to be in a university which happens to have a good background, as it were, a good, you know, championing of equity, you know, large and small. But ultimately, all the wonderful things that we produce, or whatever they're going to be, I hope they're going to be good things, they're in the hands of the vice-chancellor. So I often use the metaphor of Shamit Sayagar wandering around Australia with a silver tray. And on that silver tray are lots of what works interventions. You know, does this work? Does that work? Why does it work? What's causality? Is it replicable? Can it be transferred? Can it be scalable? So we're quite nerdy about all that, as you expect us to be. We get right down to brass tacks as much as anyone can, particularly, for example, in our data program, which is unraveling kind of a ball of wool, frankly, or our trials program, which is trying to test, you know, using sort of, you know, kind of randomized controlled trial sort of methodology and adapting it to higher education, really testing what is working and, you know, getting down to those, as I said, brass tacks. But anyhow, going back to my silver tray, you know, Martin, you're one vice chancellor that I go in front of with my tray. For argument's sake, Paul is the other. I'm just going to be a bit cheeky. Martin is a vice chancellor who's, you know, thinks he's doing a great job, but doesn't want to expend too much effort. And he loosely looks at my silver tray and he or she picks something from it. I'm just being a bit unkind here. Okay? Meanwhile, Paul, who's the good guy in this scenario, very intelligently knows where the weakness is in his student equity programs, you know, offer at his university. And he intelligently leans forward and makes the most use of what's on the silver tray. And I think the rest is clear to your listeners. You can understand the difference. So we can put lots of good things in front of universities, but we cannot force people to choose, let alone run their universities, et cetera, et cetera. And I want to put that sort of disclaimer in, not because I'm weird and obsessed by it, but I just think, you know, we've got to understand that we are we are there on that side of the equation. We are carrot, we are not stick.
Well, I'm glad that you're really good at spotting the good guys and the bad guys. I might let the good guy have a go for a bit.
Well, thank you. Well, Shamit, both you and I were on Jason Clare's ministerial, Universities Accord ministerial reference group, where we advocated, sometimes we advocated for the same points and other times different aspects of diversity. So what were your feelings about being included in this way and during the process? And how do you feel that more broadly your voice and the center's voice was able to contribute into the O'Kane report or the Universities Accord minister, Universities Accord final report?
Look, I think my general feeling is it was generally positive. I mean, you know, all very positive in parts. You know, it was good that the reference group, you know, got together and try to hammer things out. There's a lot to hammer out. You were there, and to try to do it in a kind of logical, if not elegant way. So I think we did an honest job. I would say that, but I think it could have, you know, it may not have been that. So it's a pretty good look at it. You've got to remember the Accord is very much the, and the final report is very much the end of the beginning, you know? It's not designed to have a complete blueprint and everything changes, you know, Monday week. It's about to say the direction of travel is important. And I think I support the direction of travel in general that the Accord report has produced. And I support its component parts, although the component parts are being sort of, you know, built and implemented. So we have to wait and see, yeah? But the biggest reason why I think the ministerial reference group did a good job is because it was put its collective shoulder to the wheel of something that I really do believe in. It's not even equity per se. It's the fact that actually Australia's universities and much more larger than that, its knowledge economy needs a boost, a reset, a fresh start. There's no way Australia is going to carry on being a top, you know, G7 economy, you know, 25, 30 years from now, unless we actually get our knowledge economy in the place we need it to be. And I think we're getting ahead of it. So I think it's intergenerational change, and I think it's important. I mean, people like me think that anyhow, because we think knowledge is important. And guess what? All the most successful economies and the most harmonious societies in the world make good use of their knowledge economies. They're constantly trying to expand them or steward them and develop them, okay? And this is nowhere more seen than Australia. It's very striking to me as a newcomer. I've only been here 5 years. Very striking. And I think our university's had a bit of an easy time for the last 10 or 20 years. So this boost, I think, is a bit overdue, frankly. So I think that knowledge economy is important to build. But as you build it, you want to make sure that those who are most disadvantaged are connected to it. So we're not just improving equity for its own sake, or equity outcomes. We're doing it because we want to connect people who have disadvantages today with the rising industries and opportunities and connections of tomorrow. Otherwise, they're going to be left behind or further left behind. And so I just think I got the distinct feeling the ministerial reference group basically got that. They got the vision. They knew the importance of it. Now, we can argue about bits and pieces of it and carts before the horses. And I don't know, my metaphor is going to break down. But you can hear in my voice, I've got a pretty strong backing for the exercise and the execution of the exercise. Yes, it could have been done 10% better or differently, but that's kind of missing the point. So, and I just think, you know, I think we did a reasonably good job, but the work really starts now, frankly.
Well, it does. And I mean, some of the interim report, of course, had five priorities, which we've seen some of them come through with changes, particularly the Student Safety Ombudsman. And the final report's come out with 47 recommendations, and off that, a number of sub-recommendations. Now, through that, there's a strong student-centric perspective. So what are your overall thoughts about how the different aspects of equity, diversity, and inclusion are catered for in the final report?
So again, generally positive. I think it's been catered for and addressed fairly well, fairly systematically, fairly comprehensively. You've got to make sure that you're not sort of, you know, looking for 100% answer, but, you know, it obviously deserves, you know, quite a few marks out of 10, as it were. And the thing is, I think, for me, it's quite simple to explain, which is, in the foreground is the question of now building the tools to make this happen. So it's a how question. It's no longer a whether question or a what question. And that's very much the discussion over, you know, building particularly the Australian Tertiary Education Commission. So we'll get to that in a second. But you need to build that. You need to get on with it. Okay? You've got money where your mouth is and give it a good, proper legislative base, a good, proper, you know, big brain, a good know-how sense, a good connection with, you know, best practice, good connection with all sorts of things that it needs to be connected with. I can go on, but I won't. But in the background is this other point, I think, which is important, which is as it's formed, and for that matter, as equity is re-engineered and rethought through in the 39 odd universities, there's a choice between whether it's a kind of a standalone pillar, you know, for example, in the ATEC commission, you know, whether it's going to be a single commission who champions this, I think that's fine, or whether it's going to be cross-cutting, in a sense, the responsibility for everyone who's on the commission and you know, either governing it or working in it. And I think it could be a bit of both, frankly, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm glad there will be the proposal shared by Tony Cook last week at the University of Australia, said there will be an equity commissioner. But I think we can go do better than that. I think we should make sure that it's in the sort of job description, in the blueprint for every, you know, I would call this an equity lens, that the whole of ATEC that's responsible for this, and in due course, vice chancellors and their senior executive teams, that they all have this equity or fairness or inclusion lens. It becomes part and parcel of what they do in their jobs. It's not an add-on. It's not a instead of, you know, it's an as well as, you know. So anyway, I can go on endlessly, but my main point is, I think it's landed in the right place-ish. It's got to be built, otherwise it's still aspirational. And it's got to set the tone right by expecting better equity outcomes right across the piece of all universities and of ATEC, the commission itself. And I think if you get those kind of things right, the tone, then there's real potential to move the needle.
Maybe I'll just jump in there, Shamit, because I like that description you gave earlier of this being, you know, the end of the beginning, and that lots to come, and that there's lots of support behind the overall vision. I mean, if I try and get a sense of the tone of the conversation beyond that I left Canberra with last week, and that I sense in the time that's happened since, it's probably a concern over just, you know, what appetite there will be in the government response from the budgets for getting all of this, or as much of this, and which bits of this actioned in the period ahead. And so whilst you're, I think, rightly pleased with where we've landed at that end of that opening stage, as it were, what's your sense of confidence of what the government response and the affordability in the budget will be to make that happen quickly enough?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly the right question, which is it's a combination of money and general confidence, yeah? So on the kind of general confidence, the tone, I mean, your listeners will hear in my voice that I'm not a professional skeptic, but I'm slightly doubtful about all of this. I mean, I think it's a great thing, but I just think you've got to be kind of a bit realist about these things, okay? So as I said, the design and the governance and the use of know-how and expertise by whoever's in charge, i.e. the commission, is to be taken very seriously, all right? So I think that's the thing you want to put the heart of the exercise and make sure that's done, every other good things can happen. That's not a given, all right? So even the departmental secretary stood up and said, getting the skills and expertise and the know-how and all the ducks in order to get a good start to the ATEC exercise is in itself a task. It's quite a big task, by the way. All right, so two things I'd say in response to that. One is, think it through quickly and thoroughly, and think where you can get help from. So, for example, what's this all about? This whole exercise is trying to put students at the heart of what universities do. If you do that, you automatically will, you know, be doing better on equity, all right? But not enough. So you want to put the most marginal students at the heart of what you're doing. So let's call them disadvantaged or excluded students or whatever, okay? And if you have that kind of mindset, then the good part is you will then look to other institutions who've been crunching this for some time. You're not starting with a blank sheet of paper. Now, I come from a regulatory background. 15 years ago, I was regulating solicitors in the UK, or co-regulating, sorry. And we try to put the users of solicitors, we call them clients, by the way, right? We try to put them at the heart of the legal service industry. The Legal Services Act of 2007 sought to do that. Look, you know, we can criticize it or it didn't go as far as it. But basically, we learned a lot in that exercise in the UK. Now, this is just not a UK example. I'm sure there's many examples in Australia. But all over the place, regulators or commissions or stewardship bodies, that are responsible for given industries are asking themselves the same question. And also good news is answering some of these questions, which is, what do we really know about marginal users of given X, Y, and Z sector? What do we really know about how they navigate choice? What do we really know about the things that contribute to them dropping out or having a bad experience or not getting what they're looking for? Okay. And the answer, we know so much more than we did 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And I think that's what we should be doing. We should be building an organization and its allies in the universities themselves that are on that kind of question. So I could go on, but my solution or my suggestion is pull the drains up and borrow from others that have set up similar kind of challenges for themselves. It might be in financial markets, where guess what? There's lots of marginal disadvantaged consumers that get a bad deal. It might be in transport or housing markets. It could be in anything, frankly. I mean, there's so many areas. Educational choice, compulsory education. These are all areas where people have been trying to crunch the same sort of challenge. And I just think we should benefit from that or plug into that rather than try to reinvent the wheel. Lastly, very quickly on money. Well, yeah, the money probably will be scarce and universities will be asked to do more with the same or maybe a little bit more, as it were. And that's an exercise in reprioritizing. Well, so be it. So be it. That's fine. Okay. So when you reprioritize and you arm yourself with some expertise and know-how and best practice, you probably can get better value for money from your programs. I don't know how much. I don't want to make some false promises. That's going too far. But clearly we can do better even by doing that, it seems to me. So I don't think the absence of wheelbarrow full of money is going to be a veto in all this. I mean, it would help if we had that. And so if anyone wants to, you know, cough up, and if the Treasurer Chalmers is listening, feel free. Don't get me wrong. But while you're making your mind up, et cetera, I think we just recognize that, you know, this is a start and there may not be a lot of money spare. And if we do this well, then universities will prosper and so on and so forth, okay?
And if universities prosper, more people in our society and the future economy will prosper too, I'm
exactly.
Sure.
Exactly.
Really interesting analysis with the telescope that way round, if I put it that way, Shamit. And if I invite you to turn it round in some ways, you said that no report was going to get it 100% right, and I sense that you are giving it a pretty good score out of 10 in your qualitative description of it.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are concerns over detail. I know that Paul has acute concerns about some of the detail. And if we were to drive at some of that detail, I wonder, you might want to go first, Shamit. Commenting on the relative lack of attention and mention of detail around both disabled students and staff in our universities, and some of the targets, some of the specific recommendations, some of the specific proposals in the final report. I must admit, to me, that was a bit of a surprise. And I just wonder if you have a sense of why you think that happens, what the implications of that might be, and whether that's something that's an oversight that should be addressed.
My feelings on these are, if this is one area probably the Corps didn't cover itself in glory. That's, these things sometimes happen, okay, when you're dealing with a large, complicated, you know, moving part show. So I think, you know, if it's more cock up than conspiracy, I suppose, in that sense, okay. Yeah, there are lacunas that you get with, you know, wise people on panels or commissions. It may be that disability is one of those areas that's the case. It may not be, I don't know. But I just think, you know, it's clearly not been the finest moment, I suppose, in terms of an otherwise fairly successful report in terms of equity, broadly speaking. I think it may come from a bit of muddled thinking and a bit of, the muddle that sometimes goes on in government and sometimes, you know, the grief that it causes. So, I think we're very committed in the Australian Centre in Access to make sure that, for example, you know, the basic data issues about what is the, we call it the reference value. In other words, you know, what is the comparison in terms of people with a disability in society and then within, you know, the student population or the would-be student population, to make sure that we've got the right comparator, the right so-called reference value, you know, the parity, as it were. And it hasn't been achieved. Sorry, it hasn't been sorted out so far. You know, it's not clear, never mind it being achieved. So I think there's quite a lot of room to push on that front, okay? It's a bit of a technical answer, but I think, you know, it's like, you know, if you're gonna say we want a quarter of students to come from low SES or enough that reflects their state or their neighborhood, okay, you want to make sure that you know what that number is and what it is when you break it down. Is it state level? Is it national level? Is it postcode level? I mean, there's so many ways in which you can shape the criteria. So I think all those issues. There are also issues definitional, I think, in terms of disability versus profound disability and so on. So, you know, these things have to be worked through. And we're very much committed to working them through. We're working with the department exactly on that right now to help them straighten those things out. And the last thing I think is, you know, I mean, in terms of criticisms, I think it's not really criticism, but it's an observation, which is to say, if we think, I mean, I don't know, I just don't know the answer to this question. If we think that something like the idea of universal design for learning can get us a long way in relation to disability, then we owe it to ourselves to say that and carry it through, to work out, okay, well, what does that mean in practice? What does that mean in terms of changing what at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, or what will it change in a year from now or 6 months from now? And, you know, just getting a bit granular with it, okay? So I think that sounds like a very attractive way to go. You know, it's chimes with making universities fit for purpose for all. Remember, our strap line is universities for all. So there should be something behind that, okay? Anyhow, that's just one suggestion. Again, yet again, I could go on, but I think the short version is I think most of it can be crunched and with sensible people around the table and agreeing that we want to get the direction of travel. We want to make sure we've got something robust. We want to try and stick to it once we've got it. But that's so much easier said than done, you know, and I know there's been a bit of grief about this since the report was published, but that would be my suggestion. And it's not my last word, but it's certainly my first word on the point.
Come on then, Paul, if you're a sensible table, what would you be saying?
Well, I think the fact that recommendation just had in, say, recommendation, I think it's 10, they have specific targets for a number of other groups, and then for disability just has maintained. I think that's a real miss, and I think it could result in unfortunate outcomes. And I think, but we've got to remember, this is a report to government. It's not government policy. So I think there's still a really good opportunity here, and the report's aiming for a 25-year plan. So we've got time, I suppose, to come up with a figure. And I think an urgent bit of attention needs to go to coming up with some figures so that they can be put in. And then you can't modify the report, but say this is how we are going to approach it. But then more broadly, I think there's a lot of opportunities in there to create workable solutions so that the challenges for inclusion are met. And I think the big thing is we have a lot of students with a lot of different disabilities. So, and one of the issues I think was, which has been identified in the media, was the exclusion of people who have profound disabilities from the data collection. I think that's a mistake. I think most people would accept, say, Stephen Hawking was a reasonable scientist and added some contributions. Blind would be excluded by that. So I think that's just a misunderstanding, which we should be removing pretty quickly. But as for other aspects, so there were the negatives, but the report itself talks about all students. It doesn't talk about excluding students. It mentions, say, 300 campuses. Well, they need to be accessible for all students. So that's going to involve a fair bit of work in thinking about inclusion, universal learning and teaching. You know, you wouldn't expect them to be the developing processes which excludes, you know, 10% of your student population. So I think we've still got a lot of opportunity here. And I think in the implementation, the tech and access and other bodies will be have the opportunity to come forward and create workable solutions which can help all Australians gain access to higher education that want it, which is really important, I think, for our future for us as a country and for nation building so we can meet the needs of everyone.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So come on then, both. We've talked about, you know, never get to 100%, but we're broadly satisfied, and we've talked about things that we're not happy with. But at this stage of the process, if I was to put you both on the spot and say, marks out of 10 with the beginning of the end report and where we're fixed and set to move forward, what would you give it, Shamit?
But like marking an undergraduate dissertation, isn't it? I feel I'm taking back to that. I mean, not going to beat around the bush. I think it's an 8 point something, maybe an 8.5 out of 10, something like that. I've seen many of these things over the years, so I'm trying to put in some sort of context. And given the, you know, the starting point, yeah, it's somewhere in that 8 point something out of 10, I think. One caveat, I'm always trying to look for a get out clause. It would get a high 8 point something out of 10 if I had reason to think, which I think I have reason to think, that it's got some good bipartisan buy-in, if you get my meaning.
I'll be interested to monitor how high in the eights you think it is as it goes through different stages of the process.
I'm difficult to please, mate.
A hard marker. What about you, Paul? You're a lawyer. What do you think about it all?
Oh, well, I think it's a policy proposal, not like regulation yet. So I think before my lawyer hat would come on, I'd want to see a lot of detail. And that would probably bore you and take many more hours than we have here. But I think as an overall, and I have to, let's just leave the disability issue aside because that is a pretty big concern for me. But more broadly, overall, I'd say it's 8.5, maybe even a 9, because it was widely consulted across, you know, they went around the country, industry to universities, to students. What brings together a lot of thought leadership, a lot of data was crunched, and it does represent a blueprint for the next 25 years. And it's a bold blueprint. And it's not just delivering on teaching and equity, which I know people, a lot of us talk about, but it also includes some really interesting innovations around research about how government will more use universities for research. And I think this is really important because at the moment, governments often use private consultancies where the profits from that, those consultancy goes into, you know, Learjets or whatever, whereas giving the money to universities means the money goes back into training the leaders of tomorrow. So things like that will put more money into universities without costing the government anything. But what we really need now is an Accord implementation advisory group up fast. We need the initiatives that have been started moving and those that are being developed with behind the scenes, which many of us here know about, translate into actionable research so workable solutions can be created and people like Schmidt can walk around to all the vice chancellors and others in the industry with his silver platter with good options that can start changing the country so we can have create our universities that can lead for our communities, our countries, and considering how highly ranked our universities are, really for the world.
So what else is next for Access then, Schmidt? What's next for you? And what else are you getting excited about on the back of the high eights and an 8.5 for Paul for the final report?
Well, I mean, there's a lot on for us. And if I just sort of briefly mention a couple of things, look, we've got three particular programs which we have built more or less kind of from scratch, and we are rolling them out through the front door quicker than people can sort of, you know, get ready for them, as it were. Our research and policy program is looking at a lot of this stuff, which is, you know, if you want, you know, research that can be translated in policy very, very quickly to benefit the kind of existing and future potential equity programs, not just the current ones we have. We've got a data program that's trying to, frankly, you know, unravel a ball of wool, where it's not clear what universities are measuring. And we can do a lot more, and we will do a lot more by having a fairly ambitious data strategy, which we're pursuing right now. More about that in due course. And then finally, the trials area, which I mentioned, where kind of, you know, on the ground, we can say, this is working, this isn't working for this reason, and this is what you can scale up, and this is what you can't scale up. But that's a very simplistic version. But just taking the trouble to do that at ground level, you know, I think is really important. It gives confidence in the kind of things that are on this silver tray of mine or ours, you know. It's not just abstract stuff, it's stuff that's being measured on actual campuses in fairly real time, you know. So I'm very excited about that, naturally. I think that a lot more can be done with that. Since you asked, there's one or two things I'm also excited about. I think one of them is that you should take all of this, if it comes to anything, you know, we hope we'll come to quite a lot in due course, but it's too early to tell, and connect it with what we know about disadvantage, inequality, and marginalization, you know, in other sectors. I keep on saying this. This is not just higher education. You could say the same thing about so many modern markets and public services. How do you navigate choice? And it's not terribly well done, even though we think it's well done. So I think that's what I definitely get excited about. Aim high in that sense. And the last thing is, I think we touched on it slightly, which is that I think the kind of people you need guiding this, particularly in universities, will be a new generation, the next generation of what I call academic leaders. My views on this are not secret by any means. I think we've had a long period of sort of people who are very sort of managerial, and they run universities sometimes in a kind of corporate sense, sometimes in a way that makes sure the machine and the process is at the heart of it. And it makes it difficult for either academics to see themselves at the heart of it, or let alone students. I think that's not really the right direction. I can see why it was needed at the time. But shifting to academic leaders, people who are in charge of universities, senior people, you know, deans, PBCs, VCs, governing bodies, whatever, who can get really passionate about knowledge. That's what they really are there for. And they it's reflected in everything they do on a daily basis. In shorthand, I call these academic leaders or knowledge leaders, whatever you want to call them. And I think if we get that kind of spirit in, I think you'll get a lot of good equity type things happening, because that kind of approach says that we've got something really unique here. All right, we've got knowledge and the pursuit of knowledge and the sharing of knowledge, not knowledge for its own sake. And if we can get that kind of leadership in place, and I don't think we can't, I really think we can, right? But we need to give it a push. I think we've got a really good opportunity to at least try, if not more, to get Australia, you know, the knowledge economy it wants, it needs, it deserves, et cetera, et cetera. And I think a lot of boats will rise on that tide. Now, you know, that's my thing I'm most passionate about. You know, I've been in this saddle on and off for pretty much all the time, continuously, for 37 years. And it's allows me to sort of take a view about the kind of leaders that I most would like to see. And I think we deserve that kind of leadership. I'm not criticizing individual leaders or current leaders themselves in universities. I just think it's time for a different emphasis, and we'll need it in any case. So that's just my thought on it.
What a lovely optimistic and clear picture of a way forward to finish on. Paul, did you want to say anything else in conclusion?
Well, I really think when we're thought leaders in universities, we are about knowledge. Universities create knowledge, we impart knowledge, and I think doubling the numbers of students will require a significant investment in staff from all different groups. And I think that it's going to change how Australia operates. And I think that's a really positive approach. And I think the Accord and what we've discussed here, I think we're setting a blueprint for the next 25 years, which is going to make Australia stronger. And I think provide the skills that are needed for everyone.
Well, thank you, Paul, for co-hosting another episode of Headaches. And thank you, Shamit, for being such a great guest on our show this week, and for helping us contribute towards the debate that's ongoing towards the agenda for change in higher education. I was particularly taken by your view of best practice being a way to inform what we're doing and guide the research knowledge that we can generate to make a better knowledge economy, and how that best practice can come from all parts of the world and from other sectors rather than just from within ourselves, how we're currently set up. I think that is a really important message. I think we do have a good, the end's the beginning. And I think that is a really great foundation for us to continuously inform it with some continuous fresh thinking that makes sure we do a better job of looking after our staff and looking after our students. So thanks both for joining us on Headaches. That's all we've got time for this week.
Cheers.